Welcome to Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk. I'll bring you all kinds of stories from all kinds of people. Whether it's a live public conversation and we're speaking from the kitchen table of my 1965 Beeline travel trailer, from the studios or on the streets, please sit back and enjoy the conversation right here this time every week. Trailer Talks, the Marcellus Shale Water Project, is a combination of live events, sound pieces, radio broadcasts, home movies, and an evolving interactive website that you're welcome to participate in. We're exploring the impact of natural gas drilling on New York's water resources and the issues being debated in our neighborhoods throughout the country and globally. What is guiding people's decisions about whether or not to lease their land for gas drilling? And at what point do the rights of the individual diminish in the face of the health of an entire area? What role does water itself have on the ability for an area to survive by providing for itself? What impact is this having not only on the communities in the shale regions, but also on the national dialogue and policymaking decisions around energy extraction? What defines the American dream, and how does it impact the decisions being made in our communities? Trailer Talk's Marcellus Shale Water Project explores the impact of natural gas drilling in our neighborhoods. Local culture, generations of history, and beloved homes can be lost when the oil and gas companies, intent on fossil fuel extraction, move into a new region. We're facing a complete shift in our region as this largest ever concentration of gas lies in wait beneath our feet. Please go to www.trailertalk.net and talk to us. Welcome to Barnfest 2010. We're here in Beaverkill, New York, to celebrate the Catskill Mountain Keeper, the local environmental advocacy organization, and people are pulling up. They're gathering to share what they love and what they're fighting to protect throughout this Catskill region. And today, we have keynote speaker, the author and activist Bill McKibben. The event host is Mark Ruffalo, and we will hear from the director of the Catskill Mountain Keeper, Ramsey Adams, and the program director, Wes Gillingham. We're also joined today by the musicians, Jay Unger and Molly Mason. So I welcome you to join me in this conversation about the Catskills and about what's happening in this region. And foremost on people's minds is natural gas drilling. So I welcome you to join me to talk to me about why you're here today. Thank you so much. Catskill Mountain Keeper is a grassroots environmental organization. They are dedicated to protecting the long-term health of the six counties of the Catskill region. Their mission states, by promoting economic revitalization, environmental protection, and education, the Catskill Mountain Keeper serves as a strong advocate for the protection and enhancement of the Catskill Mountains. Through a network of concerned citizens, we work to promote sustainable economic growth and the protection of natural resources essential to healthy communities. From Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, published in 1962. In Silent Spring, Rachel Carson described the effects of pesticides on humans, plants, animals, and the environment, and the impact on all of our lives. The dedication to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring is to Albert Schweitzer, who said, "Man has lost the capacity to foresee and to forestall. He will end by destroying the earth." The earth's vegetation is part of a web of life in which there are intimate and essential relations between plants and the earth, between plants and other plants, between plants and animals. Sometimes we have no choice but to disturb these relationships, but we should do so thoughtfully, with full awareness that what we do may have consequences remote in time and place. In Chapter 7, Rachel Carson writes, "As man proceeds toward his announced goal of the conquest of nature, he has written a depressing record of destruction, directed not only against the earth he inhabits, but against the life that shares it with him. The history of the recent centuries has its black passages, the slaughter of the buffalo on the western plains, the massacre of the shore birds by the market gunners, the near extermination of the egrets for their plumage. Now to these and others like them, we are adding a new chapter and a new kind of havoc, the direct killing of birds, mammals, fishes, and indeed practically every form of wildlife by chemical insecticides indiscriminately sprayed on the land. The contamination of our world is not alone a matter of mass spraying. Indeed, for most of us, this is of less importance than the innumerable small-scale exposures to which we are subjected day by day, year after year, like the constant dripping of water that in turn wears away the hardest stone. This birth-to-death contact with dangerous chemicals may in the end prove disastrous. Each of these recurrent exposures, no matter how slight, contributes to the progressive buildup of chemicals in our bodies, and so to cumulative poisoning. Probably no person is immune to contact with a spreading contamination unless he lives in the most isolated situation imaginable. Lulled by the soft cell and the hidden persuader, the average citizen is seldom aware of the deadly materials with which he is surrounding himself. Indeed, he may not realize he is using them at all. Bill McKibben is considered to be one of the leading environmentalists addressing the issues around global warming and climate change. He is an environmentalist and writer who, in addition to writing about global warming, also has authored books about alternative energy and also is an advocate for localized economies. He has written numerous books, including his first book, The End of Nature, in 1989, The Age of Missing Information, Hope, Human, and Wild, Maybe One, Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously, and in 2007, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. We speak about his current book, Earth. Bill McKibben is the founder of 350.org, which organized the largest ever global rally that had 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries. Bill McKibben is joining me at the kitchen table. Thank you so much.
What a pleasure to be here with you, and especially in this nifty trailer.
Oh, thank you. So where do we begin? I want to say I was up almost the entire night reading your most current book, Earth AA. And what absolutely intrigued me was this idea that the Earth, the planet, as I've known it, as we know it, is no longer, and so we're in a different stage of things. So I want to start there. And just now speaking at this Catskill Mountainkeeper event, too, you were absolutely riveting and talking about this global movement of awareness to try to manage a catastrophe that you're describing.
You know, it's the Earth still has the same number of continents, and gravity still works and all that. But there is no question that it's changing in powerful ways right around us. We've put enough carbon in the atmosphere to add about 2 watts per square meter of extra energy to the surface of the Earth. It's like having two small white Christmas tree lights on every square meter of the Earth's surface, which doesn't sound like much, but it turns out to be a lot.
Right.
Enough to melt ice, enough to change the way that rain works, enough to turn the oceans acid. These changes are enormous, and they're only just beginning. We can't stop what's already happened. We can still stop some of the worst that's to come.
So please share with us, Bill, what is happening? You're talking about the rate at which moisture becomes absorbed and then drops heavily, flooding. You talked about your own neighborhood in Vermont. Things that are happening in your own neighborhood. Right here in the Catskills, we've had flood after flood after flood.
And it's no mystery.
Very recently.
Everybody who's done high school physics knows warm air holds more water vapor than cold. As we've warmed the atmosphere, it's become about 5% more moist than it was 40 years ago. That's an astonishingly large change in one of the most basic physical parameters of the planet. Things like that aren't supposed to change except over eons, you know. Because there's more water up there, there's more water coming down. And so these deluges and downpours, what the engineers call a thousand-year storm, becomes ever more common. I mean, today, there's a million people trying to figure out where they're going to spend the night in Pakistan because the place where they spent last night and all their lives is now underwater. Something like that's happening almost every day someplace around the world.
And you're talking about in Bangladesh, the water shortage and what's happening with women's and girls' lives and what their day is now looking like because
We've never figured out anything to do to the poor parts of the world. We've done a lot of nasty things, but nothing that quite compares with undermining the basic physical stability of the planet upon which the poorest two-thirds of the world basically depends for their daily bread. And it's no hyperbole to say that we've done it to them. If you go to Bangladesh, you can, I mean, the whole country, though there's 140 million people there,
yeah.
You really can barely, you can't even really measure, the UN can't measure how much carbon they produce. 20% of them have electricity, but 80% don't. You get around by bicycle, rickshaw. You know, they're not causing the problem, but they're paying the price even more quickly than we are.
Well, and then there's this trying to catch up and looking at the model that the United States has set, right, with its energy extraction, fossil fuels. And you address this in your
there's unfortunately,
book.
Unfortunately, it's completely right. unfair to the developing world, but it's mere reality. If China and India emulate, as they have every right to do, what we did in the U.S., then we have no prayer of even slowing climate change. If they live as, as over the top as we have been, mm-hmm. Then the planet has no chance. That means we're going to have to meet somewhere in the middle and hope that we can meet far enough down the scale that physics and chemistry will be appeased.
So how does this tie into what's being faced right here, where we are sitting now in the Catskill region, New York State, Pennsylvania?
Hey, look, you guys are now, you know, now you know what it's like in Appalachia in the coal fields.
Mm-hmm.
Now you know what it's like in the oil regions of the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
Now you know what it's like to be a victim of the circumstance that there's something
yeah.
valuable under your soil. Now you know what it's like to be manipulated by the big energy companies who are the ones who are making the real money out of this. It's a tragedy that will be repaired only if people use it as the opportunity for building community, for building some kind of solidarity, not just in this region,
mm-hmm.
but with people all over the world who are suffering from the same effects of fossil fuel. If we cannot kick fossil fuel, then we have no chance.
Let's hear some of the numbers.
Mm.
Where do we stand right now compared to our very recent
past?
Here are the key
yeah. numbers to understand what's going on in the world. For the 10,000 years of human civilization that we call the Holocene, the Earth's atmosphere held 275 parts per million carbon dioxide. When we began to burn coal and gas and oil, that number began to go up. We never knew until 2008 where the drop-dead line was.
Mm-hmm.
But now science tells us that any amount of carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million is clearly unsafe, that we had a fairly narrow margin above 275. The trouble is we're already used up that margin. We're at 390 parts per million now. We're way past where we should be. We're not like the guy who goes to the doctor and the doctor says, someday your cholesterol will be too high if you keep
mm-hmm.
eating cheese at each meal. We're like the guy who goes to the doctor and the doctor says, look, you're already in the zone where people keel over from heart attacks and die.
Yeah.
And I suspect you've already had a small stroke and you better get to work. That's the moment we're in, and hopefully we'll use that moment wisely.
And so using it wisely, since we're in the emergency right now globally with climate change, the temperature, the amount of emissions,
so the
right?
thing we have to do
yes.
is get off fossil fuel. And the mechanism for getting off fossil
mm-hmm.
fuel is to raise the price of fossil fuel quickly so that we will quickly be spurring the economic transition that we need to make. As long as you can burn cheap coal and oil and gas, then investing in windmills and solar panels and whatever else isn't going to happen on
mm-hmm.
the scale that we need it to happen. We've got to raise the price high on fossil fuel, and we've got to do it in such a way that we don't bankrupt people. We have to take that money from the oil companies. We have to charge them a huge fee each year for the right to put carbon in the atmosphere at all. And we got to take that money and give it back to Americans. They should get a check every month for their share of the sky. They should be made whole against this increase. But we've got to do that. We've got to dismantle the business model of the fossil fuel industry, and we've got to do it really fast.
So you talked about we're past peak oil now, right?
Mm.
So there was this period, it was the party, so to speak, the cheap fossil fuels, and we're leaving that now. What you addressed in your book is that the ways to tap in, to extract these fossil fuels, and natural gas is a perfect example, you have to...
Everything's getting harder.
It's harder and harder, more expensive.
So now we got to go down beneath
yeah.
your house and, you know... pump a lot of weird chemicals into things and break it all right. up and whatever in order to get a little bit of gas out. Now to get oil out, we got to go down a mile beneath the ocean where we obviously have no idea what we're doing
right.
and mess around, you know, on and on and on.
So how do we do what you're suggesting if we're really in this, if I've had a terrible accident, I can't say, oh, wait a minute before I get help. I mean, we're in, if we're...
The only way that I know how to do yeah. it, the only method that I can think of, because historically it's been what it's taken for big changes, is to build big movements to demand them. Power and money don't yield because it's the right thing to do. They yield because they run into some power as strong as they are. And we've got to build that power. We're not going to do it with money. Exxon's always going to have more money than
yeah.
we've got. We're going to have to do it with other currency, with bodies, with passion, with spirit.
And you talk about kind of the good news here, since you're delivering such terrible news, that this is not about when things get terrible for our future generations,
right. no,
that
us.
It's us now, and only worse for those future generations. So that being, you talk about community building, you talk about really what that means to connect with each other and to...
Absolutely. And so we talk about it in the book, about the ways
yeah.
that you build local community.
Sure.
Yeah.
We'll pause. Sorry.
Oh, I'll have a brownie.
Oh, yeah. yeah. Oh, yes, please. I made them this morning. Good dark chocolate.
Very good. Mm. This is a nifty trailer.
Thank you.
Theodore Roosevelt said, "Defenders of the short-sighted men who, in their greed and selfishness, will, if permitted, rob our country of half its charm by their reckless extermination of all useful and beautiful wild things, sometimes seek to champion them by saying that, quote, the game belongs to the people. So it does, and not merely to the people now alive, but to the unborn people. The greatest good for the greatest number applies to the number within the womb of time, compared to which those now alive form but an insignificant fraction. Our duty to the whole, including the unborn generations, bids us to restrain an unprincipled present-day minority from wasting the heritage of these unborn generations. The movement for the conservation of wildlife and the larger movement for the conservation of all our natural resources are essentially democratic in spirit, purpose, and method." 1916.
So in the book, we talk about the need for local communities to do things that they need to do to make themselves resilient and strong. But we also, in the sort of work I spend most of my life doing, this big organizing at 350.org, we talk about the need for communities all over the world to join together for real political power, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't solve this just at the local level. Also has to be national and global. And that's why we've set up 350.org the way we have, so that we can do thousands of things in thousands of local places and have them add up to something more than the sum of their parts.
And so what's interesting about this is it's a combination between the local, right here in my neighborhood of the Sullivan County Catskills. You talk about food security and supporting the growing of local foods, produce, those kinds of things, other kinds of currencies. And you're also then that combined with this global network. So this is the combination.
It's the local and the global that have to somehow
yeah.
be combined. And it's not easy to do, but we have technology now that allows it to happen in a way that we couldn't have before. So we could coordinate last October 5,200 separate demonstrations all over the world in very far-flung and remote places
yeah.
and have them add up to something much larger than the sum of their parts.
And so how does this happen? Because I hear now with what's being faced with natural gas drilling in this region, people saying, well, how do we fight these huge, powerful oil and gas companies?
You got it. There's no shortcut to building a big movement. I mean, you can try to fight them to a standstill here on the ground in one place, and you may be able to find legal strategies and things that help for a while. But until the power of fossil fuel is broken, then this fight will always be underway.
And at what point do you see this happening? Kind of, what is your map?
Well, I'm not completely convinced it is going to happen.
Yeah.
I have no guarantee that we're going to win this fight. The odds are daunting.
Yeah,
we'll know if it's going to happen in the next few years, you know, because that's about as much time as we have.
A few years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so, there's no absolute date, but with each, you know, to open up Nature last week and read that plankton in the ocean worldwide has declined by 50% in the last 50 years is not a good sign. You know, it's a sign of how quickly things are changing. So
very
some
quickly.
Real urgency.
Yes, absolute urgency. And you write about that. You talk about that. You travel the world addressing this emergency we're in. So how did you, Bill, become this person who has devoted your life now to climate change?
I mean, there's, you know, when you know about things, you have some obligation to do something about them. But I'm not particularly important in this fight. What's been great is to see millions of people around the world stepping up. Now, we say we organized 5,200 demonstrations last year, but of course that's absurd. We didn't organize them at all. It was like a potluck supper. We said what the date was and what the theme was, and all over the world, millions of people in so many different places, so many different cultures figured out how to make sense of that in their place, and it was beautiful to see.
And how do you keep going with this information and the research that you do, this knowledge that you carry?
You know, the only upside is seeing how many people there are willing to fight. It's good fun to be here today.
Yeah.
And see lots of people. We'll see how many of them, you know, stick with it and fight hard. I bet a lot of them will, which is good.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the brownies.
You're welcome.
It's a very nice studio.
Thank you. It's just great speaking with you. My guest is Bill McKibben. Thank you. Talking about your newest book, Earth, Earth. Yeah. I was trying to figure out, well, how do I pronounce that?
Pretend you're Governor Schwarzenegger.
And to see you here in Beaverkill, New York, and at this Catskill Mountain Keeper event. So it was really, thank you for taking the time.
God bless. Thank you.
Thank you. On Bill McKibben's website, he says, "Welcome, citizens of Earth." That is Earth AA, his latest book. And says, "We've built a new Earth. It's not as nice as the old one. It's the greatest mistake humans have ever made. One that we will pay for literally forever. We live on a new planet. What happens next is up to us." There is a message on 350.org that begins, "Dear friends, well, no one said it was going to be easy. Last year, thanks to many of you, we built up enormous momentum for climate solutions. The global day of rallies you pulled off on October 24th turned out to be the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. But it didn't translate into political victory. The biggest polluters wouldn't go along, so we still have work to do. In fact, our slogan for 2010 is Get to Work. Get to work to start changing our communities, and get to work to make our leaders realize that they actually need to lead. Every nation is not created equal in this climate crisis, of course. If we can't get the biggest polluters and the biggest economies to change, then we'll never win. So we're going to focus some particular attention on China, the United States, and India with a great power race. And we'll keep figuring out ways to apply political pressure where it counts. In the U.S. Senate, say, where we're joining a group of our best allies in backing the proposed cap and dividend approach that would stop letting big polluters pour carbon into the sky for free. In other parts of the world, we'll hold more of the climate leadership workshops that produced so many great leaders last year. And as the next UN conference approaches in Mexico in December, the brushy-tailed ringtail possum has the heartbreaking distinction of being the first mammal species to become extinct because of global warming, climate change, erratic weather patterns, the increase of the Earth's temperature, its high fever. Is our hunger for fossil fuels, for having more, our binge on the planet insatiable? I'm thinking about our relationship to the planet, our willingness to make sacrifices, to advocate for it, which really is us, our place within the universe, as we multiply and organize, as we war and as we create, as the glaciers melt while the polar bears die, and as our mistakes and loving accumulate, can we increase our commitment to a worldwide environmental movement?
Darren McCosco. I cut logs for a living. I just think 50 years ago, 60 years ago, it was a lot different than it is now. And I think global warming is happening. just because it don't snow as much as it used to, and just you can tell the weather's a lot different. It just ain't how it's supposed to be. I'm 23, my dad's 63, and he just tells me how the winters used to be and how we used to get so much snow, and now we don't get no snow, and the summers aren't even hot no more. They're just more humid. It's just moisture in the air from, I guess, the glaciers melting. I'd hate to see the world change like that. I mean, if the climate's changing, the trees are going to grow different, and just everything's going to start changing.
Hi, my name is Joan. I think that it is many problems sort of wrapped up in one, and I think it stems from overpopulation. And I think if the human race got their overpopulation under control, a lot of the other things would be able to get under control as well.
The quality of our lives here on this planet are directly connected to the quality of the environment, and that's something that we need to maintain and to do the best we can to enhance it. And there are so many obvious examples of that. One of the most clearly one globally is the increase of the temperature around the planet and the likelihood of continued global warming. Mm-hmm. It isn't absolutely definite, but all of the evidence so far indicates that this planet is warming up. A good part of that has to do with the emissions that come up from carbon and the production of fossil fuels and the burning of all of those materials, coal and a whole host of things. These are things that we have to deal with. And we have to also deal with things that have been dealt with here in this region for a long, long time, like protecting the open environment, protecting the natural system, protecting the woods, the trees, the natural resources here in the Catskill Mountains. Catskill Mountains are a great example of the kinds of things that are so wonderful and beautiful. As I travel across the district that I represent, I travel across the Catskill Mountains frequently. It's just a marvelous experience. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, and it's something that we need to protect and enhance, make stronger and more beneficial as time goes on. It's a matter of responsibility to continue to protect this land and to enhance it, make it stronger, make it more effective, make it more livable, and make the contents of it more safe and secure for our generation and for an indefinite number of future generations.
Thank you so much, Congressman Maurice Cinci.
Thank you.
I'm Carolyn. I worry about it all the time. I really do. One thing that I think about when you use the term climate change is that I hate that term. It's so neutral. I think there's, without a doubt, the fact that what we're experiencing now is man-made. And change sounds like it could be simply and only a natural process. And I don't think that's true. I don't think anyone thinks that anymore or can sustain that belief for very long. So I'm trying to think of an alternative term, climate catastrophe, catastrophic climate change, climate crisis, weather meltdown. All of those things seem better. Global warming, too, I think it sounds pleasant. And I don't think the results are going to be very pleasant, or even now they are not.
My name is Midge Maroney. I live in Chandeli and in Manhattan.
Climate change?
Climate change. There's no such thing. Yeah, right. I think this summer and last winter is an absolute indication. I mean, you can look at weather patterns and you see that the Canadian cold air that we never had before that has just stayed there this summer. I'm not a scientist. I teach English. But it's obvious the pattern is there. It's too much change worldwide. It's definitely global change, climate change, weather change. The polar bear is sitting on an ice cube as we speak. So
from the kitchen table out on the road, I'm Sabrina Artel. To watch the Trailer Talk webisode with Bill McKibben, please go to www.trailertalk.net. To find out more, please go to Bill McKibben's site, 350350.org, and CatskillMountainkeeper.org. Trailer Talk gratefully acknowledges the Park Foundation, the New York State Council on the Arts, and the Puffin Foundation for the generous support of our work. And special thanks to the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance in Narrowsburg, New York. In addition, it's contributions from people like you that make this project possible. To find out more about the Marcellus Shale Water Project, please go to www.trailertalk.net. Thanks for joining me for Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk. The music for the show, Patti Smith, People Have the Power. Trailer Talk is produced by Sabrina Artel. For more information, please visit trailertalk.net. Special thanks to WJFF Radio Catskill and the numerous people who have donated their time, resources, and conversations to make Trailer Talk possible. Thank you all who joined me in these conversations. I'm Sabrina Artel. Safe travels.